My name is Jonathan Baugh. I'm at the University of Waterloo and the Institute for Quantum Computing. I'm actually an experimentalist, so I'm going to talk about implementations. And in particular, in this lecture, I'm going to focus on nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. NMR was actually, as I sort of wrote in the abstract for this talk, NMR was really the first technology in which quantum information processing ideas, concepts were really implemented in a physical system. So this makes so first of all, anyone entering the field of quantum information, even from a very theoretical point of view, should really understand some basic ideas about implementations and how it works. And in particular, NMR is a good sort of starting ground for that. So if you understand at a basic level how NMR works, NMR QIP, then that's actually a very good grounding for going and understanding how a lot of other implementations work, like ion traps and superconducting qubits and so forth. And I'll actually talk about some of those other implementations tomorrow in the lecture first thing in the morning. There's some, in case people are really interested in more details, more than I'm going to talk about today, there are some good books, of course, on NMR. These are just three of the kind of standard ones. And then there are also, of course, a lot of papers and reviews on using NMR for QIP, and these are three that I would sort of recommend. I'll put this up again at the end of the talk. First of all, what are nuclear spins? So if we look at the nuclei of atoms, the ones that have an odd number of nucleons possess half integer spin. So spin is intrinsic angular momentum. And those nuclei that have an even number of nucleons possess integer spin. And the ones that happen to have an even number of both protons and neutrons have spin zero. So actually, if you go and look at the periodic table, let me get another pointer here. So if you go and look at the periodic table, so you see that almost all of the elements have some nuclear isotope that is NMR active or has a non-zero spin. And there are a handful of them that are very convenient because they're spin half. And of course, spin half is what we'll focus on when we're thinking about qubits. So some of the typical spin half nuclei, the first and foremost would be hydrogen, a proton, just a nucleus of a hydrogen atom. And that's almost 100% abundant in nature. You have deuterium and tritium at very, very low levels in nature. Another one would be carbon-13. Of course, 99% of the carbon around us is carbon-12, which has no spin because it has this even number of protons and neutrons. But carbon-13 at 1% natural abundance has spin half. Similarly, nitrogen-15, and others. So, the first thing that we have to look at is how do we describe the system? And of course, when we describe the quantum mechanical system, we need to know it's Hamiltonian. The important thing about nuclear spins to realize first off is that we don't have to worry anything about the spatial degrees of freedom. All we care about are the spin operators, right? The nucleus isn't orbiting anything, it's just sort of sitting there in space. When we think about electron spins, we have to consider spin-orbit interactions and so forth, which is a little bit more complicated. But for nuclear spins, the Hamiltonian just consists of terms involving spin operators. And so the prototypical system that I'm going to use for the rest of this talk, really, is just the case of two coupled spins in liquid state NMR. And an example, a concrete example of that, would be the carbon-13 labeled chloroform molecule. So this molecule here, where you have one carbon-13 in the center, one proton, and then you have these three chlorines, which we can just ignore completely. So it's a two-spin system, the carbon and the hydrogen, and they're coupled. And so how do we describe the system when we place a sample tube containing these molecules in a magnetic field? So there are two types of terms that we get then. The first type of term here is just, we call the Zeeman term, Zeeman energy. So when we put a spin, any kind of spin, in a nuclear, in a magnetic field, the energy levels split. So we get a energy splitting between spin up and spin down, and that's the Zeeman energy. And so that's reflected in this sort of term here, where we just have this frequency, we call omega 1 here for spin 1, which is the Larmor frequency. And you can see that's just proportional to B, where B is the external magnetic field. So the larger the field, the larger the energy splitting between spin up and spin down states. So that's our qubit splitting. And most of the rest of the talk, I'll just take H bar to be equal to 1, so we don't have to worry about, so we can sort of write the Hamiltonian just in frequency units. That's what people usually do in NMR. So we have these Zeeman energies for both the spin 1 and spin 2. And then we have a coupling between the two spins. And for purely historical reasons, this is called J coupling. So we use this symbol J, which is usually given in the units of Hertz, to represent that coupling. And that coupling is actually due to, in this case of liquid state NMR, that coupling is actually an indirect coupling between these two spins that's mediated by the bonding electrons, the electrons which are forming the bond between the carbon and hydrogen. But anyway, it's not so important to understand the origin, just the fact that it's there. And in this case, it has the form which is just an icing coupling, just a sigma Z coupling. So of course, in this case, when you have different isotopes, the gamma here that gives you the Larmor frequency, which we call gyromagnetic ratio, that gyromagnetic ratio is very different for carbon and hydrogen. I think I wrote it on the previous slide. You can see that the gyromagnetic ratio between carbon and hydrogen is about a factor of 4 different. So these frequencies are very different. But now if you looked at a molecule if you're considering now a molecule where you have two carbon 13s, for example, on the same molecule, but in different chemical sites on the molecule, then in fact you would still have, in general, a frequency difference between the two spins, although the frequency difference would be much smaller. And that's because of an effect that's called chemical shielding. When you put this molecule in a magnetic field, the electrons that form the orbitals, the electrons that form the bonds between the atoms exist in these orbitals, and when you put it in a magnetic field, you get sort of little circulating currents of the electrons, and that tends to shield the external magnetic field. And so we call this chemical shielding. So depending on the chemical environment that the nucleus is sitting in, it will have a slightly shifted gamma. And so even in the case of having the same isotope, we can in general address different nuclei in frequency space and treat them as separate qubits. So that's kind of a useful tool. Of course, you know, the reason that nuclear magnetic resonance is such a useful technology in general in chemistry and physics and biology is because of this chemical shielding. I mean, essentially you have sort of a spectroscopic fingerprint of a molecule but because of this effect. Yes? Yeah. So actually, in reality, this is actually a Heisenberg type exchange. So it's XX plus YY plus ZZ. But if the Larmor frequencies are very different, and the difference in Larmor frequencies is much larger than this J, then effectively those terms just get averaged away very quickly, and you just have a sigma Z coupling. So I can explain it to you in more detail maybe later if you are interested. Yeah. So this only comes into play when you have two spins which have almost exactly the same Larmor frequency, then you would have to consider that full coupling form. So what happens when you put the spin, a single spin, just in a magnetic field? Well, from what we were just looking at, you know, the Hamiltonian is very simple, time-independent Hamiltonian. So you have this Larmor frequency is just proportional to sigma z. I mean, we're defining the direction of the external field to be along z direction. And so, you know, to look at the propagator, it's very simple. You just integrate this with respect to time and exponentiate it, and you just get this this unitary, time-dependent unitary. Now, of course, if we start off in an eigenstate of the system, spin up or spin down, then nothing's going to happen. But if we start in a superposition state and we apply this propagator, then we see that what's going to happen is that the state's going to just rotate around the equator. And we call this precession, right? It's like a precessing gyroscope, something like that. So the important thing to take away is that a spin that's put in a superposition state or along the equator in the Bloch sphere will sort of rotate around at the Lorentz frequency, or the frequency given by this term in the Hamiltonian. So what are the eigenstates and eigenvalues of this system? Well, actually, this is very, very simple because it's already a diagonal, this Hamiltonian is already in diagonal form. So we can just read off directly what are the eigenvalues. The states are just the eigenstates, which are kind of already in the what we like to think of as a computational basis, right? We call spin up logical zero, say, and spin down logical one. So the eigenstates are just in this computational basis. These are the eigenvalues, which you can just read off from the Hamiltonian. If we made a kind of an energy diagram of these states, we would see that in the absence of coupling, if we ignored the coupling for a moment, then we have this kind of symmetric, split set of states. But now when we add in the small coupling term, we find that, you know, spins which are aligned the same way are get a little bit higher energy, and spins which are anti-aligned go to a little bit lower energy. And so now we get this kind of slightly asymmetric set of states. But it's important to remember that that this this coupling actually typically in liquid state NMR, for example, is a very, very tiny fraction of these Lorentz frequencies. So the Lorentz frequencies are something on the order of hundreds of megahertz in the typical NMR field, you know, something a few tesla, up to 10 tesla or 20 tesla, whereas the coupling is independent of field, of course, and is just set by the chemistry of the molecule. And the largest J couplings are in liquid state NMR are probably around 200 hertz. So so these are very, very, these are very tiny shifts, very tiny corrections to that energy level diagram. But if we think about it in terms of what are the transitions, and thinking about it in terms of a spectrum, then we can look at the transitions of this energy level diagram. And so the only allowed transitions in NMR, which I'll talk a little bit more about how we induce the transitions in a minute, but the only allowed transitions are between states that differ by one spin flip. And so, again, if we had no coupling, in the absence of coupling, then we would just have transitions at two frequencies, omega 1 and omega 2, for this two-spin system. But now when we turn on the interactions, we get this, we modify the energy level diagram. And so we can see, for example, if we look at this peak here, this is the transition of spin 1, because it's at frequency omega 1, or close to omega 1, but in the case that the second spin is pointing down. So it's indicated by this blue arrow here. Transition on spin 1, the second one pointing down. And for example, this red one, a little bit higher frequency, is just the transition on spin 1 where spin 2 is pointing up. Right? So it's very straightforward to understand where the spectrum comes from. And again, this is a very exaggerated, the size of the splitting in this picture is very exaggerated from what I was just saying a minute ago. If these frequency difference is like hundreds of megahertz, and this J coupling is only a couple hundred hertz. So in any case, so the spin, the intrinsic angular momentum of a nucleus, has an associated dipole moment, magnetic dipole moment. And so these are really magnetic dipole transitions, and so they're driven by an oscillating magnetic field, so not an electric field, but a magnetic field. And because these are typically in the, you know, tens to hundreds of megahertz range, these frequencies, these Larmor frequencies, then that corresponds to the radio frequency, hundreds of megahertz. It's the same frequencies that you pick up on your radio. So now to induce these transitions between eigenstates, right? We know the eigenstates are just eigenstates of the sigma z operators. So to induce transitions, we know that we're going to need transverse spin operators, spin flip operators, sigma x, sigma y. Okay, and so then here's where it becomes interesting where we start to control the system. So we take our collection of molecules in a sample tube and we wrap a coil around it, which produces a magnetic field that is transverse to the previous magnetic field, the constant DC field. So the DC field is in the Z direction, and now we have an oscillating field in the X direction, let's say. And it just looks like, let's call it BX, and it has this modulation of cosine omega T, where omega RF is the frequency of this RF field. I mean, it's actually the frequency of a current that you're applying through this coil, oscillating current. So this is kind of a linearly polarized field along the axis of that coil. But you can decompose it into two counter-rotating components, right? A left and a right rotating component. And so it turns out that, of course, you know, our spin is, well, as you'll understand a little bit better in the next couple of slides, but our spin is rotating at a Larmor frequency in a particular direction. And so only one of these components is going to end up coupling to that spin. The other one is going to appear very, very far off resonance, and so we can completely neglect that. So really all we care about is one of the rotating components of this field, and that's what I've written up here. So the RF part of the Hamiltonian now just has some amplitude, which is just the amplitude which we can turn on and turn off experimentally by turning on and off this AC current. And then it looks like a sigma x cosine omega t and sigma y sine omega t. It's just a rotating field at the RF frequency with some arbitrary phase, which we can also control experimentally. So to understand really the concept of resonance, we have to make a transformation into what's usually called the rotating frame. So we want to sort of go into this rotating frame. And to do that, we can define an operator, a transformation operator, which just looks like this. And I've already written this sort of in the case of our two spin system, you know, carbon and hydrogen or whatever, so that we have a rotation operator that takes us into the rotating frame of spin one, and also one that acts on spin two. And so this operator applied to the state of our system in the lab frame just transforms it to this psi r, which is the rotating frame. Okay, so just define that. And so what we want to do then is take the Schrodinger equation in the lab frame and then just transform it into the rotating frame, where we'll have a new state, the rotating frame, state in the rotating frame, as well as a Hamiltonian defined in the rotating frame. And so this is very straightforward. You can just work it out with a few lines. It's not very difficult. And so so we transform this lab frame Hamiltonian into something that looks like this, where now instead of originally we just had the Larmor frequency, omega 1, sigma 1 z, for example, but now we have the difference of omega 1 and this omega 1 RF, right? So if this omega 1 RF is exactly on resonance, we say, or matching this Larmor frequency, then in fact this Zeeman term just completely disappears, just becomes zero. Okay, so the coupling term, same thing for the second spin at its independent Larmor frequency. The coupling is not affected, and now the RF, the form of the RF Hamiltonian is also simplified, right? Because now we're in the rotating frame, so rather than an oscillating, rather than a rotating field, the RF just looks like it's constant, just pointing in one direction. So it's just pointing along the X direction with the cosine of this phase and the Y direction with the sine of this phase. If we set the phase equal zero, it'll just be constant along X direction. So that's true for both the spin one and spin two. So, and also in terms of thinking in terms of states, I mean, it's this transformation into the rotating frame is very intuitive, right? Because in the lab frame, we just had Lorentz precession, you know, given by this expression. But in the rotating frame, this this transformation operator just essentially undoes what the propagator that we had in the lab frame. So if we form a superposition state and we look at it from the rotating frame, then of course it just remains static. It doesn't rotate. So that's kind of intuitive. And so now if we just consider, you know, one spin on resonance, then what do we have? So when we say on resonance, what we really mean just is that this the rotating frame or RF, well, radio frequency and rotating frame is a little bit confusing there, but in this case I actually mean they're actually the same thing. So when my applied RF my applied RF is at the same frequency as the Larmor frequency, then as I mentioned before, this the Zeeman term disappears in the rotating frame, and we're just left with some constant term along X, okay, or and Y. And so that just so let's say we start in a state that's pointing along the north pole of the Bloch sphere, just along spin up or zero state. So then if we turn on this this RF, then we'll start to rotate. Let's say in this case, say the RF is about the is pointing along the y-axis in the rotating frame. Then we'll start to rotate the state about the y-axis down to the x. So it's pointing along the x direction on the equator, for example. And of course, we could just keep rotating it all the way down to the one state and back again, and so forth. But let's say that we just turn the pulse on and then turn it off. Such that this the product of the amplitude of the pulse and time is equal to pi over 2, then we would have just made a pi over 2 pulse. So we'd rotate from this from the zero state to the superposition state 0 plus 1. Okay, so that's if our if the phase of our RF signal were set to pi over 2 the way that I've defined it here. So if we set the phase to something else, like say pi, then we would end up doing a rotation about the negative x-axis of the Bloch sphere. So we'd rotate this initial state down to the superposition here, this superposition state, which is rotating 90 degrees about the equator. Okay, so in NMR, we have very good control of both the phase and the amplitude of these RF fields. So it's very straightforward then, especially just thinking in the single spin case, to perform arbitrary single spin rotations. So what about two qubit gates, coupling gates? So the of course the canonical gate is the C knot, the control knot. And so here I'll just show you how this is mapped into pulses and coupling evolution for two spins in NMR. So, so again, just as a reminder, we have the Hamiltonian in this two-spin case really just has these terms: the Zeeman terms on spin one and spin two, the coupling term, and now this new RF term, which we use to apply these pulses, these resonant pulses. And so we can look at this sort of step by step. So time goes from left to right. So the first thing we do is we do a pi over 2 rotation about the y-axis on spin 2. So that just means sending, you know, a square RF pulse with the right time and the right amplitude at the resonant frequency of qubit 2, spin 2. And so that gives us this this first unitary propagator here. And then in the second interval, we just wait for a time, which is pi over 2j, where j was this coupling. And so that means that, you know, the product of j and this time is just pi over 2. So it's what we call a pi over 2 coupling evolution. Okay, so in some sense, you can think about that as if you started with an unentangled state, then this would start to entangle the states. but actually that isn't so important here. And so that gives us the second unitary operator here, which is just e to the minus I pi over 2 sigma 1 z tensor sigma 2 z. Okay, and so forth. And so then we do three more pulses, and so then the claim is, and you can go and check this in MATLAB or your favorite program, and verify that when I just multiply all of these unitaries together, then I just get the unitary for the C naught, which is that if spin 1 is in the state 0, I do nothing to spin 2. If spin 1 is in the state 1, then I just do a flip, a bit flip of spin 2. And I might have some factor of 2 error here or something, so don't be too mad at me if what I've written is not exactly right. But it should be a C naught at least up to a phase.
Sorry. Yep.
Carbon?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, we have an
or vice versa. Yeah.
So, if I have another pair of carbon and hydrogen, that's one, mm-hmm. two, let's say, apply C naught and this inversion and this one, then can it be the same thing? Because as far as I understand.
Yeah, it gets a bit more complicated when you have more spins.
The point is that you have, mm-hmm. For example, this C1, C2 is beating the hydrogen and carbon, not
Oh, okay, but in general, yeah, you will also have that, unless they're very far apart on a molecule, and even if they're not, then what you do is you do a swap between, so that you can end up doing the C naught between two spins which are locally, which are nearby each other, have a strong coupling, and then you could swap the information back to where it was before, for example. But yeah, anyway, here I'm just really considering a two spin case because for simplicity, but. I'll show you later that people have done things up to 12 qubits, so it's very possible to do whatever we want. Okay. So all of that is already about how we implement control is sort of very universal. It's applies to a lot of other technologies, not just NMR, and so that's one of the reasons I was introducing it. So here, when I start talking about the thermal state, now I'm sort of talking about a situation that's kind of peculiar to NMR, and it's one of the reasons that ultimately NMR isn't so scalable in terms of building really, really large quantum processors. But anyway, I just want to go through a couple of slides and understand why that's the case. So what is the state that we start with in NMR? Well, first of all, it's a mixed state. It's a highly mixed state, so we have to describe it by a density matrix, which has this general form. So what we have in, say, liquid state NMR at room temperature is this system of nuclear spins in thermal equilibrium with an environment that is at room temperature, and the splitting between spin up and spin down is an energy which is very, very tiny compared to the thermal energy at room temperature. So KT is the thermal energy. And we have this thermal equilibrium. So the density matrix is just given by this Boltzmann distribution, right, which is just E to the minus H naught over KT, where H naught was just this internal Hamiltonian that we defined a couple of slides back. So in NMR, we're very much in the high temperature limit, which means that if you look at the sort of the magnitude of this H0, this internal Hamiltonian, it's much, much smaller than the thermal energy. And that means that it's a very good approximation to just write out this exponential and take the first term. So we have the identity, which means a part which is completely mixed. And then we have this little deviation term, which is just proportional to the Larmor frequency divided by KT, where, again, I'm not writing explicitly Planck's constant, H bar. But here I'll write it explicitly. So H bar omega over KT is on the order of 10 to the minus 5. So it means that, 99.999% of the state is totally mixed at room temperature. But you have this little deviation on the order of 10 to the minus 5, which just has the same form as, which just looks like sigma 1z and sigma 2z. And it's proportional to the Zeeman, to the Larmor frequency. Sorry. But it turns out that in NMR, the identity term, first of all, we can't change it by pulses. Nothing that we do with RF pulses can change the identity term. And we can't observe it either. And I'll talk about what we can observe in a couple of slides. But so it can't be observed. It can't be manipulated. So the only part that's important for us is this deviation part, this small part here, which is proportional to the, which just looks like the internal Hamiltonian. And again, we don't even, strictly speaking, we should also add in the J coupling term. But since the J coupling is, again, on the order of, you know, 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6 times smaller than these Zeeman energies, then it's completely negligible for this. For this discussion. So that's our density matrix describing the system. So it just looks like omega 1, sigma 1z, omega 2, sigma 2z for this two-spin system. So what can we associate the sigma z operator with in terms of a state? Well, it just indicates a population difference between spin up and spin down states. So if our state was completely mixed, if it was just the identity matrix, then we would have the same number of spin up and spin down. Right, and you know you don't know anything about the system, but if your density matrix is sigma z, then it means you have some population difference. And so that really just means that there are a few more spin ups than spin downs in the system, and that's what we measure and exploit when we do NMR experiments. Now, of course, this thermal state on its own isn't very useful because, you know, if you want to, for quantum information processing, because you really want a state that looks like a pure state, you know, starting off with all spins up, for example. So what we really want is a pure state, or at least one that behaves like a pure state. And like I said before, the identity part of the state isn't observable, doesn't matter. So as long as we can produce a density matrix that looks kind of like this, maybe, where we have an identity part but then a small deviation part that just has the same form as a pure state, then this is called a pseudo-pure state. And this actually can be used to do quantum computing or quantum information processing in NMR. It turns out, though, that actually this the procedure for making this pseudo-pure state is non-scalable, in the sense that for every additional qubit you add to the system, when you prepare a pseudo-pure state on that larger system, then the amount of signal that you get, the amount of state that's left in the pseudo-pure part is exponentially small in the number of qubits. So this was kind of the original downfall of NMR in terms of being a scalable technology. But nonetheless, with small numbers of systems, with small systems, you know, up to around 10 or 20 qubits, we can still use this pseudo-pure state methodology. And so how do we make a pseudo-pure state, for example, in our toy system of hydrogen and carbon-13? Well, the deviation density matrix, we can just write like this. Remember I said the difference in Larmor frequency was about a factor of 4. So we can just roughly say that the hydrogen part is 4 times its sigma operator, and the carbon part is 1 times its sigma z operator. And so this, in matrix form, it just looks like this, which is obviously quite different from a pseudo-pure state, or a pure state, which would just have an entry in one of these eigenstates, of course, and the rest should be 0. But we can sort of do a trick. So we can apply 3 different permutation circuits to this thermal deviation density matrix, and then we can add up the results. So the first one is actually doing nothing, so we just get the same result. The second one is this combination of control knots, which just permutes the values on the diagonal, and then we just do the same thing in reverse, which is a different permutation. And if we add them all up, then we see that we get something of this form, which looks like, okay, this is looking like what we want, right? Because now this looks like something times pure state added to something that's just proportional to identity matrix. And this identity part, of course, can just be absorbed into the large identity part that's already there. And so now we can, for this state, we can just consider the deviation density matrix to be proportional to this pure state. And so in practice, what this means is that for every computation that we do on this system, we actually have to do the experiment three times, and we proceed the experiment by each one of these different permutation circuits, and we add up the results at the end. And then the result that you get is exactly the same result that you would get if you actually started with a real pure state. But at the end of the day, it's not a real pure state. So it's kind of interesting that this works. Okay, and then how does measurement work? How does readout work in NMR? This is another part of the NMR technology that's a little bit specific to NMR, so I don't want to spend too much time going over that, but it's just good to kind of give you an understanding, a flavor of how it works. So as I mentioned before, we have a bunch of these molecules actually on the order of like 10 to the 20, so a macroscopic number of these molecules in our sort of sample tube. This stopped working. Okay. And we can consider this really to be an ensemble of identical non-interacting processor molecules. So this is really convenient because it means that, you know, we don't have to consider the Hamiltonian of all of the combined, you know, 10 to the 20 spins. We just have to consider the Hamiltonian of a single molecule. And then we just have many, many copies of the same system, and they don't interact with each other. But nonetheless, we have this macroscopic quantity. And together, the nuclear spins form a bulk, what we call a bulk magnetization, or like a magnetic moment of the entire sample. And, you know, in the simplest terms, that's just the magnetic moment of each one of the nuclei multiplied by the the number of up spins minus the number of down spins, right? So when we just put the system in equilibrium in the magnetic field, as I mentioned before, we have a small excess of up spins over down spins. And that just corresponds to now we just add all of those up over the sample, and that gives us a macroscopic magnetization. And it's this magnetization which is what we actually detect in the readout. So just like I was saying before, when we're thinking about a single spin and rotating from the from an eigenstate to a superposition state, well, in terms of our density matrix, we start with a state which is just along the z direction in the Bloch sphere. And we just apply our 90-degree pulse on resonance, and we just rotate the magnetization from the z-direction to the xy plane. So now our magnetization is along x. And just like with the case of the single spin, the magnetization just precesses in the xy plane at the Lomar frequency, right? Because the magnetization is really just summing over all the spins in the sample. And if all the spins are pointing the same way, or the excess of spin up over spin down are pointing the same way, they all precess the same way. So the bulk magnetization precesses in exactly the same way. And now the same coil, which we used before to apply our excitation pulses, we're now going to use to couple to this precessing magnetization as a way of detecting it. So and that works through Faraday's law in physics, which says that an oscillating magnetic flux induces an EMF or a voltage in the coil. Okay, so this and so in sort of more quantum mechanical terms, this corresponds to an expectation value measurement. So the observables are really the expectation value of the X magnetization, the expectation value of the Y magnetization, where you're just tracing over the density matrix, which describes the state of your system, and the transverse spin operators, sigma x and sigma y. So these observables we call the transverse magnetization. And just to give you an example, for, you know, let's say we just wanted to know the state of a single spin in NMR. So a single spin, just having a deviation density matrix that points somewhere along the block sphere, and you just don't know where. So how many experiments do you have to do? Well, in the case of a single spin, you only need to do two experiments. So in the first experiment, you don't do anything, you just detect. And you can measure both the X magnetization and Y magnetization, and that tells you in one shot what are the projections along the X and Y direction. And then you do a second experiment where you rotate by a pi over two poles, and then you measure. And now the part that's along the X direction was telling you what was the component along Z, right? Because the component along Z just gets rotated by this pi over two poles, and then you measure it out. And so those are the only three things that that you need to know to do sort of tomography on a single qubit. Unfortunately, you know, independent of NMR and in any implementation you want to think about, the number of experiments that we need to do full state tomography grows exponentially with the number of qubits. So so when you go to large systems, tomography, full state tomography is not all that practical. So we have this precessing magnetization inside your coil. And so what that, as I mentioned, that induces a voltage, an oscillating voltage. And so that's what we really measure. That's what our spectrometer measures. And so if we plot that oscillating voltage, of course it decays because, you know, we have relaxation and decoherence processes acting on our system. The signal doesn't last forever. It decays on some time scale, which is typically given by T2, a dephasing time scale. So that's the time scale over which the signal decays by roughly 1 over E. So the value of the voltage at the beginning of at T equals 0 is just proportional to the magnetization, the expectation value of our magnetization at T equals 0. And so this is sort of how we measure that. At, and then we take this signal and we Fourier transform it, and then we can see the discrete peaks that correspond to those NMR transitions that we have in the system. And now, of course, after this Fourier transform, a signal which decays on a timescale of T2 is going to have a peaks that are broadened by something proportional to 1 over T2. So the width of these peaks is given by the inverse of T2, roughly. Okay. And so this magnetization is a function of time that we're measuring in the signal. It's just you take your starting state, the density matrix at T equals 0, whatever it is, like that could be at the end of a computation, and then you just evolve it in time under the internal Hamiltonian and take the trace of it, and that gives us just our magnet, just gives us the signal that we measure out here. And we call that the free induction signal or free induction decay. Okay, so that was measurement. So now onto a topic which is a little bit more general and applies to all systems, although we just saw in NMR that when we measure a signal, it decays on a time scale of T2. And so just like any quantum system, any physical implementation that we can think of, we always have processes of relaxation and decoherence. And probably, you know, you've probably seen this in much more detail by other people, other speakers at this workshop. But I'll just give you sort of a little bit of theoretical perspective. So we can think of this, we can treat this with the general cross operator formalism, where the cross operators sort of map the density matrix like this, and we have this normalization condition on the operators. So we know that we know sort of a priori that when we talk about relaxation means a process which exchanges energy with the environment, right? And so we know that relaxation for a single spin is going to involve transverse operators, sigma x and sigma y. So just like, you know, just like in for rotating a spin coherently with a field, with an RF field, we need to use these transverse operators in a similar way. Noise in these operators for a single qubit is what produces relaxation. And of course, it's going to be noise that's somewhere near the Larmor frequency in frequency that's going to be the most effective at relaxing spin system. And then on the other hand, dephasing, if we think about pure dephasing, then we think about phase flips, and that's the sigma z operator. So it's going to be noise that couples to the sigma z operator of the spin that induces dephasing. So an example would be and just pure dephasing. So our error operators, this is one way of looking at it. I'll show another way of looking at it in the next slide. The error operator just looks like a very small z rotation, okay, about some angle phi. And so if we want to, so this picture is sort of appropriate for thinking about our NMR sample, which contains many, many identical copies of the system, but where, you know, each copy is in some, you know, statistically different local environment, right? And then, so in that case, to model what's going to happen with this kind of noise operator, this kind of fluctuations in the environment coupled to the sigma z operator, then we would take this this noise operator acting on rho, our density matrix, and then just integrate it over some distribution, some statistical distribution of these angles, phi. And so it turns out that if this distribution is kind of like a Lorentzian distribution that's kind of expanding in time, right? So it's kind of like your spins are sitting there being influenced by a noisy environment. You have some statistical distribution of these small rotations, but over time, the rotations get bigger and bigger. And so this is kind of then like a Fourier transform. And so the Fourier transform of the Lorentzian is just an exponential function. Right, so if we look at our single spin density matrix and we parameterize it by these numbers A and B, then we see that the part along the diagonals doesn't change. That just indicates the populations of the spins. But the off-diagonal terms, which indicate these superposition states, decay on a time scale of T2, where T2 was just something that was part of this this function. Okay, so for pure dephasing, nothing happens to the populations, but you just get an exponential decay of the coherences or the off-diagonal terms in this particular model, right? Okay. So another way of looking at this pure dephasing is kind of from more kind of an error correction point of view, where you have a map acting on your state rho. Which just says that there's a probability P of a phase flip, and of course your probability for nothing to happen is 1 minus P. And so so now the system is described by these two cross operators, and this P, this probability for a spin flip, is just given by this function of time and this parameter T2. And in that case, I mean, I didn't write it again, but in that case, you would recover exactly the same kind of time dependence to the density matrix, just an exponential decay. And so on the Bloch sphere, you know, of course, this pure dephasing just looks like the Bloch sphere being squeezed in from the equator. So it's just getting pushed in towards the center, like a football. So on the other end of the scale, we have pure relaxation, which can be described by a little bit more complicated set of cross operators. You can just see this discussion from Nielsen and Chuang. And so we have that map acting on our density matrix. Then now the populations are time-dependent as well as the coherences. Okay, so what you can see here is that, let's say you start in some initial population A in the in this first entry in the matrix, then over time you just that just decays exponentially to some equilibrium value, which I write a zero, and similarly on the other term. And then the important thing to take away from this is that is now the decoherence rate of the coherences. So in this pure relaxation limit, where you don't have any pure diffasing process, but the only process is relaxation, then these off-diagonal elements, these the coherent superpositions, decay on a timescale T2, which is just given by 2T1. So this is the longest that T2 could ever be, right? T2 is always limited by T1. And in general, in most systems, you don't reach this limit. So generally, T2 is usually much shorter than T1 because you have additionally to relaxation processes, you have some pure diffasing process too. So for example, in liquid state NMR, typically, T2 is somewhere in the range of half a second to a few seconds, 5 seconds, say. And T1 is typically a bit longer, maybe from five to 20 seconds. So in NMR, typically you're sort of intermediate, really. You have both dephasing and relaxation, and the decay you see is really dominated usually by dephasing, but it's somewhere intermediate. And so I've talked a lot about the theory in physics, but then how does it actually look in the lab? Well, so you have this this big superconducting magnet, which is just some coils of superconducting wire sitting in liquid helium, and you put your sample right in the middle of that magnetic field, so that produces your strong DC field along the Z direction, and then the sample is actually sitting in this thing we call the probe section, somewhere inside here, and this probe section contains that solenoid coil, or effectively something that behaves just like the solenoid coil that I drew in the previous slides, that produces the transverse RF field. And, some circuitry that goes along with that RF circuit. And then, you have some all of your electronics for generating pulses and detecting the small NMR signals is in some console here with a bunch of electronics racks. So that's just, sort of a flavor of what it looks like in the lab. And so how for example would we do something kind of simple like the Deutsch-Chose algorithm on 2 qubits? I'm assuming that most people probably know roughly what the Deutsch-Chose algorithm is. It was one of the first quantum algorithms discovered, which allows you to differentiate between functions on a binary bits that are either to discriminate whether the function is either constant or balanced, which means that the function is either dependent on the input bit or independent of the input bit. And classically, of course, this takes two queries of a particular function to determine whether it's constant or balanced. But in the quantum case, using this Deutsch-Chose algorithm, it only takes one query. And so this is the circuit that does that. This U sub F is your query, is your implementation of that function. So in this one query, then you get a result here, which tells you if the function is constant or balanced. And this was done with NMR a long time ago, more than 10 years ago, actually, 11 years ago. And you can see it's actually pretty simple. So the first thing you do is you prepare the pseudo-pure state, which means I've just preceded this experiment by, let's say, these different sequences, which you can then add up to make the pseudo-pure state. And so, we can assume that we start with 0, 0 on the state of the hydrogen and carbon. And then we just apply some sequence of pulses here. So a pi pulse on the carbon to turn it into a 1, a logical 1 state. And then we can simulate these Hadamard gates with just a pi over 2 pulse, because a Hadamard just has pretty much the same effect as a pi over 2 pulse. Actually, we could make pulses that implement exactly the Hadamard gate, but actually you don't need to for this experiment. You can just do a pi over 2 pulse. And then in the case of, I think these, what I've drawn here, are for the case of the two, so there are four possible functions on one bit. And I think the two functions that I've written here are the, in the case of the balanced functions. And it turns out that those are just like C-naught gates. So it's like the C-naught gate, very similar to the C-naught gate that I showed you before. But the only difference is that at the end, whether you have one function or the other, just depends on whether you do a rotation plus 90 or minus 90 degrees. And then basically you just read out the signal. And the phase of the signal tells you whether the function is constant or balanced. And so, you know, if I reverse the phase by 180 degrees of the pre-induction signal and I take the Fourier transform, that just corresponds to a peak being flipped from pointing up to pointing down. So when I look at it after I take the Fourier transform, I look in it in the frequency domain, then you can see for the two functions which were constant, the peak is pointing up. For the two functions which were balanced, then the peak is pointing down. So this was done, again, a long time ago, just an initial demonstration of the ideas of QIP and NMR. Of course, the level of control, the fidelity of the experiment probably wasn't great in these first experiments. But you know, just to give you an idea, I mean, the people that have been working on this NMR stuff from that time till now have really come a long way. So the state of the art now is looking at a molecule with 12 nuclear spins, 12 nuclear spin qubits, a histidine molecule. This is work that was going on recently at IQC. They were able to demonstrate the creation of a pseudo-pure state in that system. That was published actually already a while back, 2006. And recently, some interesting work benchmarking control. So asking the question, you know, what is the average error in a gate? Because we know that for fault tolerance, we would like something that's, you know, close to 10 to minus 4. And so this is actually an experiment that's starting to be done in a lot of systems like ion traps and superconducting qubits. And you know, just for kind of comparison, this benchmark, a couple of PhD students at IQC did this last year or a year and a half ago. And so they applied this randomized benchmarking scheme that was originally developed by Manny Knill at Los Alamos for the case of a single qubit, and they extended it to the case of three qubits, and then they did the benchmarking on this molecule here, where you have two carbons, C1 and C2, and this hydrogen. So basically the idea is that you have almost, you know, sort of certain prescribed way of coming up with a set of kind of randomized gates where you put in sort of randomized Pauli operators in between, and you just sort of look at longer and longer sequences, and averaging over a lot of sequences, then it allows you to kind of statistically get a very good approximation for what is the average gate error. And so for a single qubit, actually now with all the improvements in control that we've applied to NMR over the past few years, we're actually able to show something on the order of 10 to the minus 4. And then in this three qubit case, for control over all three qubits, you know, including all of the two qubit gates that you can do in this three qubit system, average gate error of about 0.5%. So that's pretty good. And so, I mean, what's encouraging about this is it shows that, you know, a technology where people originally did this and might have seen fidelities of like 85% or 90%, and now we're, you know, with sort of not that many years between then and now, have already been able to get to a level which is almost good enough for fault tolerance. So I think that sort of bodes well for a lot of other systems where, you know, you might see, well, there's some gate that somebody did in this new system with ion traps or something, and it was only 95%. But, you know, the point is that maybe, you know, 5 or 10 years, it's really easy to believe that these things can be pushed to, 99.999% fidelities. And in many cases, that's already happened in these new in some of these other implementations. And I think this is actually the last slide, just to show that we've also, and also work at IQC, we've also been able to demonstrate a similarly kind of high level of control in solid-state NMR. So solid-state NMR is kind of the same idea, except now we're looking at molecules in single crystals. And in this particular experiment, it was looking at a three-qubit processor molecule that's embedded really and a bath of hydrogen spins, spin bath. And the algorithm that we implemented is called heat bath algorithmic cooling, where we essentially cool the processor qubits by controlling the interaction with the bath. And that involved doing a lot of logic operations within the qubit subspace as well. And so we're able to keep cooling the qubits in our processor up to 4 iterations of this particular algorithm, which, and if you sort of work out kind of back of the envelope, then you also need to be sort of at the error rate of about 1% per operation to be able to do that. And for technical reasons, it's actually a lot harder to get high fidelity control in solid state NMR. So this was also pretty good. I mean, we're not quite at the level of 10^-4 error rates, but it's still encouraging. Okay, actually, that's all I wanted to say about NMR. So I'll just put up these books and reviews, and feel free to ask any questions. Maybe first.
Can you go back to the do-it-yourself algorithm?
Sure.
Doing, yeah. So can you see like a team of them now, or you start from C phase and then you perform a local function?
Sorry?
Can you make a real team directly, or you start from C phase?
Oh yeah, so you're starting from a C phase. Well, it's sort of a sigma z
yeah.
interaction. Yeah.
And then you have another
item. To make a C naught, so it's this combination of so the thing between the dotted lines is pretty much a C naught up to some global phase. So you have these pulses, right? You have the pi over 2 pulse here and a pi over 2 pulse there.
Can you really make a C naught? I mean, directly, or start from C phase?
No. I mean, you basically. What do you mean directly?
Certain time, period time, and then just apply C naught, or like more optimal, just start from C phase.
Yeah, so this is like the second one. So you have this, the C phase is like the natural evolution.
Yes.
And then you do some local control to turn it into C naught.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you could easily do 12 qubits in one liquid sample. So do you have is it technically possible to have very small radio frequency processor so that you can use the same magnetic field and put a number of them beside each other, or they may interfere with each other?
Actually, not sure what you mean. So
because I think the expensive part is the mm-hmm. magnetic field to produce mm-hmm. in this experiment.
Well, no, I mean, we're not so much worried about the expense. I mean, what we're worried about is the fact that this problem I pointed out with the pseudo-pure states, right? As you go to larger and larger systems, so we have this 12-qubit molecule now, right? But let's say we make a pseudo-pure state. So the amount of signal that corresponds to that pseudo-pure state is some signal level, right? But now let's say we add another qubit, so we make it 13 qubits. If we try to make a pseudo-pure state on that system, the signal of the pseudo-pure part would decrease by a factor of 2. And if you add another qubit, another factor of 2, right? So ultimately, you just run out of signal to noise. And then if your signal to noise is equal to 1, then you can't do the experiment anymore.
Yeah, but is it possible to put a number of small vessels beside each other?
Yeah, you could, but I don't think that you would gain any advantage from doing that. Maybe we could talk just after, because I'm not quite sure what you mean. Sorry?
To add more and more cubes, mm-hmm. you need to use larger and larger cubes.
Yeah, I mean, if you went this direction, like the liquid state NMR direction, then you would just need to find larger and larger molecules.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess quantum computation is useful if you have, for example, 1,000 qubits, but does it mean that you need a huge molecule with 1,000?
Well, yeah, I mean, in this particular approach, I mean, you can imagine maybe some variations on the approach where you have nuclear spins in some kind of more engineered environment. right? And you have kind of artificial chemical shifts, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, just using this molecular approach, then that's really the only thing that you can do. And that's kind of, I would say that that's, you know, maybe that's one of the practical considerations, you know, reasons that it's, you know, not so convenient to think about going to 1,000 qubits this way. But the real fundamental reason why you can't is this problem with the pseudo pure states.
And I guess as your system becomes larger and larger, finding these pulses would be hard. I mean, I guess it's a non-trivial problem, and it should be.
Well, actually,
is there an efficient way to find these pulses?
Yeah. So it kind of depends on how you implement these algorithms, but. So there's a scalable way, right? So the way that most of the experiments have been done in NMR up until now, the way that you find that you design the algorithms and the pulse sequences, that part by itself is scalable. So there's no problem with that. Because you don't. Yeah, but I mean you don't have to simulate the whole quantum system to find the pulse, right? I mean, like, I know that that this set of pulses here makes a C naught between two spins,
yeah, sure.
Right? And so.
But when you have a lot of qubits, then they are always interacting with each other.
Yeah, but so we know efficient way to refocus that with pi pulses. Yeah. So I mean, to be more honest about it, there's a scalable way of doing this, and there's a non-scalable way of doing it. And so the non-scalable way is to find control pulses by simulating the whole system. And we've done that in some experiments just to see if the control can be better. But there is a completely scalable way of coming up with these pulse sequences on arbitrary number of qubits. So, if there are no other questions, then thanks a lot.